Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. Jim McLennan was one of the first fly fishing guides on Alberta's Bow River. A well-known writer and speaker, Jim has authored 4 books and written countless magazine articles. In this episode of Anchored, we discuss why we fish, how Jim got his start in the fishing industry, what the Bow River used to be like, and how we change as we get older. This episode is brought to you by Norvice. From their original 1970s prototype to their new legacy stainless steel vise, Norvice has been committed to one thing: efficiency. The company's long-standing slogan, "Tie better, flies faster," truly encompasses what the Norvice fly tying system does. The good folks at Norvice believe that you deserve to tie your flies consistently and in less time because of the ease and benefits engineered into this outstanding tying system. For more information, visit www.nor-vice.com and check them out on YouTube to see how you can maximize your tying time by relying on the functions and benefits of the tested and true Norvice. Also, if you haven't already, please go check out my new site, Anchored Outdoors. Over the last 6 years, many of you have been asking for videos of my guests in action, and that is exactly what we're doing over there. From masterclasses to free articles, we've taken Anchor to the next level and have got no plans of slowing down. Head on over to anchoredoutdoors.com and have a look at our membership options. I'm even temporarily offering all loyal listeners a 20% off code just as a thank you for tuning into the show. After all, Anchored Outdoors would never have come to fruition if it wasn't for you guys. Simply enter the code LOYALTYCODE20, no spaces, all lowercase, during checkout, and you'll immediately knock 20% off the total. Hop on over and use the coupon while it's still active, and I'll see you over there in our private community.
I was born in Edmonton, Alberta. Do I have to say how long ago?
Yes, you do. You do.
I do. A long time ago. Okay. In 1953.
But that's not that long ago. Well, maybe. I'm not.
I'll ask you when you get there. No, I won't. Cause, you know.
So Edmonton, I mean, I don't know how I feel about Edmonton. I'm assuming you didn't stay there.
No, I was born there and grew up there, went to university there, and then moved to Calgary in about 76 or something. I moved down for a couple of years. I moved down in the summertime when I was in university, so to guide on the Bow, and then realized it seemed sort of silly to move back to Edmonton after the fishing season and then move back again in the spring. So we got married in 77 and, yeah, we've been in southern Alberta ever since then.
Is Edmonton, I've only admittedly been in the city. I think I've done some fishing out of there, but not a lot. It doesn't feel like it's quite the outdoorsy community as Calgary is. Is that right?
Well, it would certainly be right for fishing, trout fishing and moving water. It would definitely be true. there's good fishing around Edmonton. It's almost all lake fishing. And, you know, and I would say probably the whole walleye pike thing is, that's the big deal. And lots of ice fishing because there are quite a few lakes. But there are some good, what they call pothole lakes, which are small stocked lakes quite near Edmonton within an hour's drive that have pretty good fishing. I fished there when I first started fly fishing. And also we spent our summers in Jasper Park when I was a kid. My parents used to pull a trailer up and we'd stay in a campground. And that's where I started fishing. That was almost all lake fishing too, which is kind of funny because I fish lakes almost not at all now. Although that was, you know, the first places I fished were lakes, but I always kind of had the desire because in all the reading I was doing about fly fishing, it was moving water that really seemed to be the big deal. And so I was intrigued by that. And, you know, that I confirmed that as I spent more time on moving water. And that's just about all I do now. Nothing against lake fishing. I think it's probably more technical and more difficult to understand than stream fishing, but I don't have time for both.
Yeah, I understand. Well, it helps having your timeline because if you were really gung-ho about fishing in the 70s, that puts a lot of things into context for me anyway. So just going back a little bit further to when you were in high school, were you keen on fishing then as well?
Yeah, I was. Let's see. I started fly fishing, I think, when I was 12. My dad was not... He was always interested in fishing, and he always had intentions of taking up fly fishing, and he got all the stuff, but he never kind of got around to really getting deeply into fly fishing. But he had some friends that were, and notably in that group, it was a great pal of his, Lee Perkins, who was the owner of the Orvis Company. And now, prior to buying Orvis in 1965, Lee was in the same sort of business my dad is. My dad was. My dad sold automotive equipment wholesale. Like he was, and Lee represented a company that made welding machines. And Lee is a great guy, and he still is. He used to come up. He would always schedule his sales meetings to Alberta to see my dad and for their annual, you know, pitch on the new product or whatever it was. He would always schedule those in October so that they go duck hunting. The first time he came up, he realized my dad was an avid duck hunter, which he was. So it'd always be in October. And the other funny thing is back then you couldn't hunt on Sundays in Alberta. So my dad would always schedule the sales meeting at his store on Sunday. So they wouldn't lose a day to hunting when Lee was up for his thing. So that's where it started. And, after he, acquired Orvis in 65, Lee sent my dad a bamboo fly rod as a gift, which my dad never used much. I used it a little bit and broke it, of course, because I was, you know, 14 or 15 years old or whatever. And so that's kind of where the fly fishing thing started, more from friends of my dad's than through him. And that's, you know, I've had a long, I don't have any formal connection with Orvis now, but I did work for them as a sales rep for a few years. And so that goes back a long ways, the Orvis connection.
Do you stay in touch with Lee?
Yeah, a little bit. Not really often. I forget how, he must be, I should have looked this up. He's close to 90 and he still fishes a lot, hunts a lot. We were down there. He has a place in Wyoming, and Linda and I and our daughter and son-in-law were down there, I guess it was 6 years ago, and spent some time with them fishing with them in Wyoming. And I'm in contact with him some. His wife is actually pretty active on Instagram and that sort of stuff. And not very long ago, she posted a picture of Lee with a great big bass he caught in Florida. And so he's an amazing guy. He's been a mentor to me, and not in a formal way, and he would never, you know, think so probably, but I've learned a lot of stuff from that guy relative to fishing and hunting both.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. I wouldn't have gathered that. Okay. So then you graduate high school, and I'm assuming you went to college.
I did. I went to the U of A, and I actually got an education degree, I started out in the science faculty because I thought I wanted to be maybe a wildlife biologist or, you know, one of those guys who tags bighorn sheep or, I don't know, some, those are the kind of things I thought were interesting. But I never got, I couldn't sort of see that at the end of the Bachelor of Science degree I was, you know, enrolled in. We were doing, you know, dissecting smelly fetal frogs and stuff like that. And I thought, this isn't what I want to do. So anyway, I switched out of the science faculty into education, but with an ulterior motive. The other thing that's always been big in my life is music. And I really wanted to get some better music education, but I didn't play a concert instrument, so I couldn't get into the bachelor music program. So the backdoor way to get some music training was in education with a music major. So I got a education degree majoring in music.
Yeah, because you play the guitar, right?
Yeah.
And you play well.
On a good day.
Yeah, I've heard you play. I think you play beautifully. So now talk to me about music then. Did you end up going and doing something with that?
When I was doing the guiding on the bow, that was in the summertime, and I was playing music in the wintertime, mostly at that time as a, I was trying to do it as a solo, you know, solo act. And I was a starving musician in the wintertime and a starving fly fishing guide in the summertime.
Perfect.
Yeah. And I've continued to play. I did kind of get away from it for quite a few years, but got back into it maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And it's not something I ever would plan on, you know, making a great deal of money from. But I really, really like to do it. It's a fascinating thing. And I'm as hooked on music now as I've ever been, really. So
guiding on the bow, was that the 70s or?
Let me see, 53. From the mid 70s to the mid 80s, probably.
What was it like back then? Was it busy or was it still pretty quiet? Or is that relative? Oh,
it was quiet. It was quiet by any way you want to measure it. When I started, it was in conjunction with a tackle store that my friend ran, and he thought, well, we should start a guiding service on the river. And so that, whatever that was, 1975, I mean, initially there was basically me, and we added some guides through the next, you know, 5 years or so. And what really made it grow was we started inviting some of the big name American outdoor writers to come and fish. So, you know, they came and, you know, in the late 70s through the early 80s, the river was really, I mean, it's still really something, but then, I mean, there was nobody else, not nobody fishing it, but not very many. I'll give you an example to put that in perspective. I remember one day having kind of an argument with one of our other guides because I was going to do a certain stretch of the river. I don't remember which one, but, you know, 10-mile stretch of the river or whatever. And I said, well, I'd like to do this one. And he said, but I wanted to do that one. What am I going to do if you're in the same stretch of river? So, like, two boats was too many. Those days are gone almost everywhere now. So
you're the heart of it, because that's, if I'm all the timelines right now while you're speaking are all kind of filtering back into my head. And you're right. It was all kind of a boom and they were writing about it. And I didn't really know where it started, but you're saying that you were there right at the beginning. It was you and your crew.
Well, when the publicity started, I was there, and as I've told a number of people, it was a great thing for me, because all these guys, all my heroes, wanted to come and fish the river I was puttering around down. So I got to fish with almost all of my fly fishing heroes. And they didn't come because they wanted to fish with me. They wanted to fish the river, and when they got here, I was what they got.
Right.
You know, so I learned a lot of stuff, and I mean, it was a wonderful thing to be able to have spent all those, you know, a lot of time with a lot of the greats of the sport, you know. So I don't know anybody who's probably as lucky as I was to be able to do that back in, if you want to call that a golden era of fly fishing or something. So
how did you reach out to them? It's always so interesting to me. I mean, obviously you'd have to write letters, or did you get on the phone?
Well, a lot of that was done. I wasn't running the company. So I was working for my friend Russell Thornberry, who he did all that. He sort of set it all up, and I don't know how he did it. Actually, it didn't take very long. I got Lee Perkins to come up, and he wrote a thing after he and his son Dave fished one September day with me, and I had great fishing. And he wrote a story about it in the Orvis News, which is their, I guess still is, their in-house newspaper, which probably even then had a bigger circulation than any of the magazines. So that one thing got the word out, and then I think some of the other guys started calling and checking and seeing, you know, I'd like to come up and fish and write about it. What, you know, what do I have to do? And so I think Russell reached out to some of them, and some of them probably reached out to him to come up. So
here's a question for you. If you could do it all over again today in 2020, say that you had a river, not very many people were on it, you were in your 20s. Now with the internet and the difference in access, would you do it again?
That's a very good question, and I don't know. I've thought about that sort of thing a lot, because I was definitely involved in bringing attention to the river, to the Bow, and to the other streams in Alberta, because I wrote magazine articles and I wrote books about it. I did give it what I considered careful consideration before I, you know, wrote about them, and was kind of convinced that some places I think you need to keep secret, and some places need to have people know about it. And a river as unusual as the Bow is, flowing through a city of now well over a million people, and subject to all kinds of different influences from irrigation to the city and all sorts of stuff. Somebody has to care, you know, and somebody has to speak up. And history has always shown that the people who have the greatest concern for the resources, the people who enjoy it. And so I thought, well, yes, I'm okay with doing that. If it came along now, it would depend on the situation. You know, if it's a place that needs some help, and, you know, is under some kind of a threat, then yeah, maybe I would. So I don't know. I don't think I can particularly take any credit for this, but perhaps the Bow is still a great trout stream, partly because so many people care that it remains so. You know, if nobody cares, nobody's going to do anything. And so one of the surprising things to me, you know, people always say, well, the Bow, it isn't what it used to be. It's all crowded now. But if you had asked me or any of the people who were doing this at the time, you know, in the 70s or whatever, they said, well, in the year 2020, there'll be 1.25 million people in Calgary. How do you think the Bow River as a trout stream is going to be? We'd have probably said, I don't think it'll be doing very well, because, you know, how could it with that many people and, you know, all the things that, you know, big populations of people bring, but it still does. And so the provincial governments and the city have slowly come to realize there's value in, you know, something like the Bow here. And unfortunately, when you say value, that means it has a dollar value to it, but that's the only thing that really gets anything done. So if they think it's worth protecting because it's bringing money to the city, well, now you're talking, you know. So did I avoid the question?
Well, I think you handled that well. What's the story with the Bow and the fish in it? Are they natural? Were they stocked?
The fish are rainbows and browns, neither of which are native. The browns were introduced, I want to say, again, if I had been really clever, I'd have reviewed some of the stuff. I think, I can't remember, maybe 1915 or something, you know, in the story, whether it's really true or not, it seems to be the only report on the source of the brown trout is that there was a hatchery at Banff, a fish hatchery, and they had some, you probably heard the story, and the truck was heading for a lake somewhere, and the truck broke an axle near a bridge over a little tributary to the Bow. So the driver of the truck, they weren't going to get where they were going. So he just opened the door and let them fall into the, into the creek. That's the story. Maybe it's, you know, urban legend or rural legend. I don't know, But certainly that is the only record of any stalking of the brown trout. It might have been 1910. I forget. And the rainbows, there's no specific records, but rainbows were commonly stalked in a lot of water in Alberta in the probably 1940s, somewhere around there. But there, neither one of the native browns, of course, are native to Europe and the British Isles. But the rainbows, the speculation is they came from California steelhead stock because they were also used a lot in then. But they have not been stocked for a long, long time. Alberta stopped stocking wild trout in moving water in the 1950s and was one of the first places to do that. Montana didn't stop it till the 70s. But Alberta biologists figured out that the best thing for these streams, if we want to have a healthy population of fish, is not to stock them. It's to let they'll fill up on their own if the habitat's there, and that, you know, that's still true.
Yeah, and if anyone wants to really dive into that story, I podcasted a couple hatchery biologists recently on my other show called Into the Backing, and they dive full into that study. It's really interesting. Now, Jim, this all makes sense that you started writing back then, because what a lot of people might not realize is for ages you were my editor over at Fly Fusion.
Yes. And you didn't send me any nasty emails, I don't think.
You helped me become a better writer. I appreciate it. I still sometimes go to write something and I'll remember, like, amidst instead of amongst, and I'll be like, oh no, Jim told me that I need to watch that. And how did that all happen?
Oh, becoming an editor. Well, I don't know how that part happened. The writing part, I like reading about outdoor stuff, especially fly fishing and bird hunting stuff. And I, for a long time, I thought I would like to try writing a story. It took me forever to try it, but I did. And I don't know, it was 1979 or something. And I sold it to a magazine, and you know, I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. So I just did it because I like to do it. And the editing thing, I don't really know how that came about, or because I haven't edited Fly Fusion magazine the whole way along. I certainly didn't start doing it. I guess Derek Bird probably was doing it for a while. And then, I don't know, I just got the call from Chris or Jennifer and saying, would you like to edit the magazine?
But it was a natural evolution. You didn't go to school or something to be a writer, did you? Or
no, I didn't. In fact, I took some English classes when I was in university, but I paid no attention. I scuffled through, and I probably passed, but the interest was not there yet. So no, I didn't. The editing thing just came from, I guess, learning over time, what you're talking about, just paying attention to what you put down, not being so in love with what you just said that you can't kill it if it needs killing, yeah. You know? That sort of stuff. Right. And so I was happy to kill other people's stuff too. So
yeah. Now I'm jumping around here. Let me get back to your timeline. So, okay. So you're guiding on the river, you're popularizing this fishery. And then how long did you end up guiding for?
Well, I think, as I said, I think I started in 75 or 76. And then in 1982, with two fishing friends, we started a fly shop, the first fly shop in Calgary called Country Pleasures. And I guided the...
Oh, my goodness. I'm so sorry. Everything is just clicking. You know what's really sad? Sometimes when someone's so close to you, because I feel like you've been in my life for a long time. We go on a fishing trip, you're there. I go to an event, you're there. You're on an email chain, you're there. Sometimes someone's in front of you so much that you don't even see them. I mean, all my worlds are colliding right now. So Country Pleasures was not started by the Giffords. It was started by you?
Yeah, it was not started by the Giffords. It was started by Neil Jennings, Ron Dutcher, and me in 1982.
Cool.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, sorry to hijack your story. Keep talking. So you started a fly shop.
Okay, started the fly shop, and I guided some, I think, maybe the first year we were open, and then it became clear you couldn't do both. You couldn't be on the river and in the shop, or I mean, it was not working very well. So I basically stopped guiding, and you know, whenever that was, 83 maybe, and just focused on the store stuff, and we ran our own guide service and that kind of thing. So I didn't do it all that long, whatever it was, 76 to 83 maybe.
Okay, and then how long were you in the shop for?
I was in the shop 18 years till 2000. And then I went to work for Orvis as a funny title, a regional business manager. That's what my card said, but it means sales rep.
So. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. And then along the way, you've met Linda in here somewhere.
Well, let's see. We would have met in probably about 70. Oh boy. She might know. So I got to be careful.
Yeah.
Maybe 74 or something like that. 73, maybe something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Cause she's an avid angler and an instructor as well, right?
Yes. Yeah. We both teach and she loves to fish and is really good at both the fishing and the teaching and is a really good photographer and stuff too. So it's a nice, you know, we've been able to do something we both are passionate about and, you know, almost make a living.
Almost make a living. What about the schools then? So you guys had the shop for 18 years. Where do the schools come into play?
Well, when I left Orvis, we had to decide, you know, what are we going to do to make a living? And so I remember we spent quite a long time, Linda and I did, kind of, you know, doing the imaginary scenarios. Well, if we could do this, if we could make this much money from maybe can we teach fly fishing schools in the summertime and then, you know, carry on with the writing stuff in the winter and a little bit of music thrown in here, how would it look? And so that's really what we've done. So I guess we've run our own, you know, fly fishing school or instruction entity as McLennan Fly Fishing since 2004. So whatever that is, 16 years. Wow. And so so that's kind of been one of the many ways we sort of cobble together a living. And, you know, none of the things we do on their own are enough, but you know, gathered together, they've kind of worked. So
can we talk a little bit about just the progression internally and kind of the ups and downs of all of this? Because right now, as a man in your 60s, you're talking about a life that a lot of people in their 30s are, and maybe even 40s, maybe 20s, you know, but a younger generation is looking to achieve or to follow, you know, follow in your footsteps, do something similar. I know that there's a lot of this fantasy mindset that it's going to be not easy as such, but you're going to be so happy doing what you're doing that it's not going to feel like work. And sometimes I like to just kind of nip that in the butt and talk about the realities of it. Can you talk to us a little bit about your roller coaster? I mean, when it's good, when it's bad. Maybe let's start at guiding. When did you know that you were done guiding?
Well, that was more because of the reality of having the store. And, you know, I had to know what was going on and contribute to what was going on business-wise in a you know, retail store. So it was, I mean, we all kind of agreed, at least that's why I remember it, the three of us, that I just can't be on the water and then also know what's going on here. So that was a pretty easy decision. But you're right. You have to have a certain temperament. In some manner, I've never been able to sort of get away from. That's not quite true. I would say second guessing myself. With guiding, I initially for quite a few years that I did it, I would come home at the end of the day, and if it hadn't been, you know, as good as everybody hoped it would be, and there's lots of days like that, I would, you know, I'd lay in bed saying, I should have floated that other bank. I shouldn't have stopped in that spot. Yeah, that was a bad idea. You know, maybe I should have done that other float. And you just can't do that. You do the best you can when you're there, and then you got to just, you know, walk away from it at the end of the day. And the teaching is like that too. I mean, a lot of what we do is, well, we teach sort of beginner schools, which are partly indoor classroom stuff and partly dry land casting and then some stuff on the water. We also teach intermediate level schools for people who've fished a while who want to, you know, get better at something. And those are all on the water. And I have a hard time getting past what I think people's expectations might be because if they've, you know me by reading my stuff or whatever, I kind of think, uh-oh, they figure that because I wrote a book or something, that if they come out with me, they're going to catch 47 fish. And no, that's not going to happen. I'm gonna, hopefully I can teach them some things that'll help them catch fish beyond today. But I always worry that they're always a little disappointed that, yeah, I learned lots of stuff, but I didn't catch as many fish as I thought I would. That, I don't know if that people are really like that, but that's kind of in my head a little bit. And so I've never been able to ditch that. Makes you try hard, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It puts a lot of pressure on.
Yeah. And I don't, as I say, I don't know if that that's really what people are thinking, but it's just the way I kind of assume they're thinking.
Yeah. No, I can tell you for a lot of people, that is what they're thinking. And I don't think it's a deliberate thought process. It's just, this guy must know what he's doing. And because he's the best, I have a chance at catching more fish.
And I would like to think they do, just not that day.
Right.
After that.
Yeah, exactly.
They practice.
Okay. So then you do whatever you, what 90% of the people I speak to who are considering starting a new career do. You have a fly shop. What about the ups and downs in the fly shop? Because you hear varying reports, but a lot of the fly shop owners I speak to really hate it. And a lot of the shop owners I speak to really love it. So what was it like for you?
Well, it was good for me because I needed to do something. And the only thing I knew anything about was probably fly fishing. So it made sense and I was happy to do it. It is not easy. Not an easy way to make a living. There's very few people. There'd be some, but very few people who would have made a lot of money in an independent fly shop. And in recent years, a lot of them, even some of the ones who were very successful, have gone out of business. And, when I was doing the sales rep thing, I think I had a pretty good perspective on it because I had, you know, been in the shop for 18 years and now I was being a sales rep and calling on shops. So I could relate to their problems and I knew how difficult it was. And, there were quite a few stores, quite a few guys get into a fly shop because they fish and they think it would be a neat idea. And so you can have a fly fisherman who starts a business, or you can have a businessman who starts a fly shop, and the latter are more successful. You know, they have to have some interest, obviously, in the sport. But if they don't understand, the principles of business and bank loans and all that stuff, which is not my natural habitat either, and I'm still not good at that, but I had to sort of struggle with it. I mean, you got to know that stuff as much as you know how to double haul, because and these days, with the one thing we never had to deal with, at least not very much, just a little bit, was internet sales. That's a huge thing to try and, as well as the competition from other stores. There's more stores, or certainly around my part of the world than there were when I was doing it. But that great unknown factor of, the online sales or that's something you really got to think hard about if you're going to start a fly shop today. I wouldn't want to be negative to somebody, but I would want them to think really carefully and to get some good business counseling before they just leapt into doing a fly shop.
What do you think is the number one thing that's overlooked in starting a fly shop or in operating a fly shop?
I think when I was with Orvis, they used to tell us that the greatest cause of fly shops going out of business was being underfunded. You got to be prepared to lose money for 3 years if things are that, that's very, very normal. So if you think I got enough money, to see us through the first year or two, that's not enough. you gotta have enough to really withstand the rainy days and maybe more so in the West where I am, things like drought and floods and forest fire seasons and pandemics. Not that you prepare for that.
Yeah, right.
There's a lot of, unknown factors that you've got to be able to weather financially. That, you don't put in a business plan, but they can show up. So,
what about the evolution of, your own evolution through writing? I remember I wrote an article some time ago that you had edited for me, and it was, I can't remember, it's been quite a few years now, but it was about, I was writing about not wanting to go fishing that morning. And I remember you saying that you've been there.
Didn't we correspond about that a little bit?
We did.
Yeah, okay.
Can we talk a little bit about that? Because I think a lot of people, I know for me at that time, I was going through a real confusing part of my life. I was so gung-ho. I wanted to fish every single day. And then all of a sudden, and I think that's what I'd outlined in that article, I had gone to brush my teeth to go fishing and I didn't want to go. I think I wanted to drink coffee instead. And I was very confused by that. And then
you wondered what was wrong with you, probably.
Yeah, that's right. And now, as a more mature adult, I understand exactly what was wrong with me. But I think a lot of people who are listening may have a similar situation and they don't know what's wrong with them. Can we kind of talk about that and what that means when you wake up one day and suddenly you don't want to go fishing?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it can be different for different people. I think it's hopefully kind of part of the natural evolution of things. Once you've done it a while, I mean, it's not that and I've certainly, my intensity has slipped or whatever over the years. And some of that is just age. I know that happens because it's happening to all my friends who are the same age or older than me, but it's kind of natural. You get, so it doesn't matter so much. It's a real cliche to say it, but it doesn't matter so much about the fish. I like going and I like catching fish. I like catching them in certain ways. If I can't catch them the way I want to catch them, okay, I'll try again next time. Not that drive is not the same, and that's for sure. And I think some of that is an evolution of when, you caught a bunch of fish, and I don't know. Sometimes I do question what we prove by catching a fish anyway. That's another whole thing.
But that's the sort of thing that I end up facing often. And I go back and forth on it depending on the species. But sometimes I'll catch a fish and I just have this really strange moment of why does this matter again? It is so silly because back in the day, I'd be so stoked about it. But every once in a while, I get hit with this real harsh slap of reality that's like, yeah, but why does this even matter right now? I mean, is there something deeper to that? Or is it just like all of a sudden one day you're seeing the light for what it is?
I don't know. It's a bit of a sticky, sticky spot.
And a lot of us don't want to talk about it. I know my husband was like, don't you talk about this stuff when you're podcasting, because people will think you're losing the passion. And it's like, well, hold on. I'm not losing the passion. There's certain species where I can tell you right now, I would fly around the world to go and catch, but there are other times and days and fish where, and I'll admit it's usually on a day where I've got other things to do, right? Like if I've got more important things to do, but I'm going fishing, those are usually the days where I'm like, why did I just spend the day doing that? I really have other things that are more important to be doing. But I don't think it necessarily means that you're losing the passion for fishing if you get hit with that slap of why am I doing this again? I think it's something deeper.
Okay. What?
I don't know. Do you think that?
Whoa.
Do you think that?
You're
gonna tell me. No. I wonder if as fly fishers, if there's this, I mean, so many of us start as conventional anglers and we start to go and, get our fish to bring home to eat. And I'm just going to kind of stammer here because I wasn't going to talk about this. So I haven't really thought about what I'm going to say yet. I'll just word vomit and see what comes out. But, I feel like we start as gear fishermen. We catch our fish to take home for dinner. It's exciting. We want to catch more fish, obviously, because it's so exciting. But then we get to the point where maybe we can't take those fish home. We have enough, or maybe it's a species you can't take home because it's illegal. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden you're so focused on catching more fish. Then you get dialed into wanting to catch the biggest fish. And then you want to catch the biggest fish the hardest way. And then I feel like to complete this circle, right before a lot of us end back at going to catch fish to take home again to eat, I feel like between those two junctions, there's like this little tiny halfway one that makes you consider why you're doing it all over again. Does that make sense? Like I can see the circle in my head coming all the way around 360.
Oh, yeah.
And then right as I get to like 340, there's this like little tiny nodule that's like, well, do you really want to dive in from the beginning again? Like what is the, what is the point of it all?
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. I haven't I would say I haven't gotten to the point where I want to catch fish and take them home to eat. But I will also say that's not wrong. Taking fish home to eat where it, the, you know, it's in a place where it can be, the fishery can be sustained, or it's a put and take fishery. That's not wrong. That's where this came from. This is a blood sport.
Oh, so you never came back to take fish home again. I think a lot of, and I'll preface by saying so many of my friends and even other anglers that I know are hunters, right? So like a lot of us have circled back. The more we've gotten into hunting, the more we feel the need to take some of our fish home. But that didn't happen for you?
No, and I don't mean to, I'm not trying to be a snob about it. I guess most of the places I fish these days, you can't take them. I do like the idea of taking, you know, going someplace and catching a bunch of little brook trout and taking them home and eating them because they're so good. And I'm not opposed at all to the premise of eating what you catch. It's funny because I've hunted my whole life. I've only hunted birds. I've never hunted big game. My dad never did, and I never got started. I don't have anything against it. I just, again, don't have time for it. But I've hunted birds pretty much my whole life too. And the whole thing about the hunting is the dog. I hunt with you know, we have with pointing dogs, and so we're hunting upland birds with pointing dogs. And I just really like to see the dog do his thing. And you're much more of an observer. I mean, you're a participant, but much more of an observer. When I go out to hunt for a day, almost always I come home with 0, 1, or 2 birds. And I'm perfectly happy with that. But I got to see the dog do his thing, and I got out in great country, and you learn stuff and you see interesting things and all that. So, you know, I like to eat the birds too. They're I like them.
Delicious.
So, yeah. Oh yeah. But it's, I guess I've never quite taken that last step. It's probably partly because it just isn't really feasible most of the places I fish these days.
Yeah. So then what's the next step? And you're right. Just this is so dependent on the person. As a mom, I obviously take a lot of pride and joy cooking for my daughter. So I love going and catching us a fish, especially when we're in camp in BC, taking it back and enjoying that fish with her together in the cabin. But if I wasn't able to circle all the way back down to where I'd started, I think something would slowly be dying in me in a lot of my fishing. What is your next step in the journey?
Well,
let me be totally frank though. Are you still excited? Like, do you wake up in the morning and say to yourself, I can't wait to go down and catch and release a trout right now on the Bow River?
If I can do it the way I want to do it, and I can't help sound like a snob here, but what I like to do most is fish for rising trout. And if I can go down and find some rising fish and fish to them and catch a couple, I do get excited about that. But, you know, less excited about the other stuff. And this is going to make me sound terrible, so don't use this part.
No, because this is really important. I'm not going to edit this out. Use your words wisely if you'd like. I'll leave what you say, but just make it be something that you want people to hear. Because I think we need to be honest about it. You know what I mean? I don't pussyfoot around on the show, and I want to be honest for people who are confused about their own journey, because there's a lot of them right now.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose. I think people just have to understand that it won't always be the same. You're not going to nothing is going to stay the same. And I don't really know, in my circle of people I fish with, I don't know many of them that are my age or in that range that do it as hard as we used to. And we do talk about that. And I've even written about this a little bit. You know, a full day, what I would consider a full day of fishing now is probably about 5 hours. Whereas it used to be 9 or 10 in the morning till dark, you know. So, I had a funny conversation with a longtime fishing friend a while ago. And we were talking about this sort of stuff. And we used to stay out till dark to fish on the Bow and other places. Drive a couple of hours, fish till dark, you know, which is 10 o'clock or so. Then drive home, then I get up and go to work the next morning. we don't do that anymore. And some of that is just natural, the effects of age. But I asked him, I said, I wonder if the fishing right around dark, the dry fly fishing right around dark is on the bow is good these days. And I said, do you know? He said, no. I said, me either. I haven't been out till dark and I don't even know how many years. It just, you know, when you're done, you're done. And it's okay. But here's the thing. I don't know that we enjoy it less because we don't go as hard as we used to. That's kind of the whole thing for me is, you know, when you're young, you go as hard as you can and you like it and you have a great time. When you're this age, you go a lot more leisurely and slower. But who gets the most enjoyment?
Yeah, it's dependent. It's funny. I've been exploring this within myself on a, you know, whenever that slap of reality hits, I try to pick it apart to figure it out. And I figured out a couple things for myself. I figured out that for me, that I do still have days where I go hard, but they're always because I'm really eager to find adventure or really excited about finding an adrenaline rush somewhere around the next bend. It's almost always based on adventure. The days where I used to fish just to fish hard, I looking back now and being totally truthful, I think I was trying to prove something to myself.
Oh.
It was before trying to prove anything to anyone else. It was trying to prove to myself, A, that I was a good angler, B, that I was really avid, that this was what I wanted to do. I mean, C, just a big part of me was like, you can't be hardcore if you don't fish for 12 hours a day. I feel like I was constantly trying to prove something to myself. And because every time I went out, there was such a state of discovery that I was going through. I was always learning about myself. But I know myself so much more now. I have nothing to prove to myself. And I just learn a lot less about myself when I go out there. I mean, I still learn about myself and can hear, you know, hear thoughts that I wouldn't be able to hear otherwise if I was working or busy chasing a toddler. But I just feel like I have a lot less to prove to myself. Is that anything you've ever experienced?
Yeah, I think maybe that's what I was trying to say when, you know, I like to do it the way I like to do it. And, you know, just catching a fish for the sake of catching a fish. Okay. But I don't feel driven to do it. One of my recent Watermarks columns in Fly Fusion is called, I think it was called Why Do We Do It? And I guess I talked about some of the stuff. I can't quite remember what I said, but how did this get to be so important? And, you know, and I think some of the other aspects that it brings are truly are important, you know, being a good steward of the resource and, you know, and being watchdogs and all that sort of stuff. That truly is important. Whether I can catch the biggest fish on the boat today, it's not that important.
Coming up, Jim and I continue our conversation. Again, thank you to Norvice for making this episode possible. The good folks at Norvice believe that you deserve to expect consistency and efficiency out of your tying system. When tying on the Norvice, you will quickly see the benefits of tying flies while physically spinning the vise. This is a remarkable feature that I strongly recommend watching on their YouTube channel. There are a lot of great rotary vises on the market, but only the Norvice spins the hook. It's for this reason that it's been said that Norvice is the most innovative fly tying system on the market. Never again do you have to wind slack thread onto your bobbin spool. The Norvice auto bobbin does the work for you. For more information, visit www.nor-vice.com and check them out on YouTube to see how you can maximize your tying time by relying on the functions and benefits of the tested and true Norvice. So what about now? What are you up to now? Are you still, would you consider yourself in the fly fishing industry?
Oh yeah, we're still doing the schools, and I'm still writing. I'm not editing anymore, but I'm still writing for some magazines, and we're still teaching fly fishing schools. We are trying to sort of wind it back a little bit, and so yes, I would definitely say I'm in the fly fishing business in that way. I'm also still really interested in the whole writing thing, and I would like to, as I get older, do more teaching of writing or writing workshops. We got a writing workshop scheduled later this summer. It's a whole weekend thing, and I'm really looking forward to that because you'll know this as when you're a writer, you never get to talk about writing to anybody. You can't just bring it up to somebody on the street. You know, I wrote a really good paragraph this morning. I feel really good about it. Oh, okay, great. Let's get funny looks.
Total glaze over.
Yeah, like what? Yeah. It really is. I don't know. They call it a lonely profession or something. It really is. And I like talking about it with people who also want to talk about it. And so I think I'll probably end up doing more of that sort of stuff in the waning years of my career or whatever.
When it comes to writing, how do you stay passionate about it if you don't want to write about how to? Do you find yourself, well, it's a two-part question. Let's start with that one, and I'll ask you the second part after I hear your answer.
I think most writers would say they have to have some creativity, and there has to be some originality in what you write. While it's not as obvious, I suppose, how-to stuff can be written creatively and in a way that engages the reader. You know, that's the objective, is to engage the reader. Keep them with you till the end of the piece. So it's a real type of writing. How-to writing is a very legitimate type of writing. And I would rather write, I guess, about why than how, but there's a way bigger market for how. So you kind of have to do that. And if you can, you know, work on being original, you know, the originality can come from three places. People always say, not always, a lot of people say, oh, the fishing magazines, it's just the same old stuff, you know, rehashed again. It's one more story about strike indicators or, you know, mending or something. And it's true because there's only a certain amount of new stuff. And I guess the amount of new stuff is probably diminishing as we go forward in time. But the creativity, the originality can come from what you say, how you say it, or in the audience. If the audience hasn't read it, you know, yes, the hardcore people like us have been reading this stuff for decades. And yeah, I saw something like this back in the 80s about whatever this topic is. Okay. But the vast majority of the people reading today haven't come across that. So, you know, the audience can be original or what you say. If you really got something really new and that somebody hasn't thought of, okay, great. Or in how you say it. And that's both the creativity and the originality, I think.
Do you ever find yourself trying to think of topics that'll stir people up? Like, do you go out of your way to try to find something to stir the pot?
Not a lot.
Because I feel like you do, Jim. I feel like I read your articles sometimes and I'm like, ooh.
Well, yeah. I don't know what the word is. I like taking little subtle shots at people that I know. And I do that from time to time, especially in Fly Fusion with, you know, somebody named Derek. I like to take a run at Derek once in a while. And yeah, I guess I do. Not in any sort of a serious way. I kind of stay out of the political stuff because it's not my strength by any means. I did just write a piece, a back page, a seasonable angler piece for fly fishermen I think it'll stir people up a little bit, but in a good hearted sort of a way.
What's it about?
It is called A Requiem for Matching the Hatch.
Okay, do tell.
Yeah, it's like when I grew up learning to fly fish, the whole thing was what bug is hatching, how do you find the right fly, and imitating that when the fish is eating these bugs, ideally on the surface, and you got to imitate pale morning duns or blue-wing olives or something. And while that's still around, there's been it seems to me, and what I see in here, maybe it's just where I live and fish, big surge in, and I don't know how to put this, cause I mean, this is tongue in cheek, but big foam bugs. That's all you need.
Okay.
Big foam bugs. So And in the piece, I made up this make believe scenario of somebody who goes fishing and comes home and immediately puts the fishing report up on Facebook or Instagram and says, "Man, there were bluing olives hatching all over the place, fish rising everywhere, and I slayed them on size 6 Chernobyl ants." Okay. Anyway, it seems like there's not as much a little bit of the focus or appreciation for what I always thought was the major sort of challenge and confrontation in fly fishing for trout, which is a fish feeding on the surface and you've got to imitate what he's feeding on. Seems like that's sort of taken a backseat to catching fish on ridiculous looking flies.
Well, it hasn't in New Zealand. New Zealand's still very true to
good
to matching the hatch. You would love. Have you done New Zealand yet?
New Zealand, yes, not for a long time, but yeah, I really liked it. I would go back.
Do you feel like the sport is losing its romance, or do you feel like now more than ever the romance is starting to flourish?
I'm not sure if worry is right, but I wonder if a lot of people are sort of losing. They know where we are, but they're not quite sure how we got here. And I think there's value in understanding how we got here, like just the history of even fly fishing in North America. It's pretty interesting, you know. And I'm just being an old crotchety old guy, but I think there's value, and people should know what a Quill Gordon dry fly is and that sort of stuff. So yeah, I worry that some of the depth of understanding maybe isn't there. I don't know. That's pretty presumptuous of me to say that.
No, I'd say you're accurate.
Yeah.
I'd say you're accurate, but I think that the desire to learn more about it is there. And I know simply from my audience, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of my listeners are younger, and it's really interesting because I hear from a lot of them saying, "I really love your interviews, especially when you sit down with older people in the sport." And I think that's good. Because they're desperate to learn about the history, but it's very intimidating. I have a huge library and I go in there. I haven't read 90% of those books and I don't even know where to start. But then all the history is there. I just don't know where to start. So let's give them a piece. I mean, you just said which fly did you say? The Quill?
I just said Quill Gordon, just off the top of my head.
Gordon. Yeah. Okay. The Quill Gordon. Why don't you take a moment to think of the most interesting historical story you can think of right now for someone who started fly fishing last week. Take your time. Someone who started fly fishing last week. And they're like, "Oh, well, I mean, I know it's interesting, but wasn't it just a bunch of rich old white guys and didn't it have something to do with England?" If you were to say, "Yeah, but listen to this story," what would that be?
Well, I don't know. I'm just kind of reaching here, but there's a book by Ernest Schwiebert called Trout, which incidentally was the second book called Trout. I don't know how he sort of got away with another book called Trout. The first one was written by a guy named Ray Bergman, and it's a great book written in, I think, the 40s or 50s. But anyway, Schwiebert's Trout came out in the 70s. It's 1,500 pages of everything in the world you could ever want to ask about fly fishing for trout and grayling. There's, I don't know, a few hundred illustrations. He did all the illustrations himself. And just the depth of knowledge that guy had about this sport. That's something, you know, that still impresses me. So that, I don't know whether that's the kind of story you're looking for or not. The other one would be the creative, critical thinking of some of the sport's real leaders. And I'm thinking first here of Gary LaFontaine, who died a number of years ago from ALS. He never took the way we used to do things as being just sort of right by default. He would always say, "Well, I wonder why, you know, let me just start at the beginning. I'm not going to do it this way because that's the way we've always done it." And he would, got under the water with the snorkel gear to look at the bugs as they're emerging and to even watch the fish feeding on them. What do they look like? How do they behave? How does my imitation compare. And he came up with all kinds of unusual flies. If you look at a lot of his flies in his books, you think that looks stupid, but read about it. And he'd say, well, that works under certain situations because when the light is low and the sun is low in the sky, there's more red in the spectrum that this sort of stuff. And, these are this sparkly antron looks like the air bubbles that are attached to the body of the caddis pupa when it's swimming to the surface, stuff like that. And you look at his stupid looking flies and you read about why they look like that. And you say, oh, okay. Now I understand. That makes sense. So that kind of thinking impresses me.
And it's really interesting when you can learn more about the person as well, right? Like for me. So I'm a history buff, and what you just said about the flies. Yeah, that's interesting. And you have my attention temporarily. But then if you told me the story about Gary LaFontaine, and admittedly, I don't know a lot about him, but let's just take someone like Joe Brooks,
okay,
who is a historical figure where I do know a bit of his history because I podcasted one of his relatives and watched the documentary. Yeah. Joe Brooks Jr., who actually lives here in Australia.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And have you watched the documentary?
I think I've seen a trailer or something. I will, though. I'll also tell you this because it relates to what we said. Joe Brooks was Lee Perkins' fly fishing hero.
Oh, well, that's not a surprise, actually, come to think of it. Yeah. So. He was a mentor to a lot of those guys, wasn't he? A mentor, but a figure.
Yeah, he was a trailblazer, I think. And, you know, fishing out west and, you know, Yellowstone Park and all that sort of stuff. He wanted people to know that they could fly fish. And not presented as something that was too difficult to do, but that it was something that you could learn to do really easily. And so.
See, so knowing these guys' stories, so beyond the fly, but the person themselves, the trailblazers themselves, that's really interesting to me. That gets me really excited. That makes me want to go and fish the streams that Roger Keg Brown did.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I know a little bit more about the man himself. So, I mean, obviously that's not for everybody, but you're right. There is something about understanding more of the history to feel connected to it, right?
Yeah, I agree. Just as a little aside, a long time ago in my first round of fly fishing TV, we did a show at Hague Brown House in Campbell River. And that was really neat because we went out and fished the pool kind of behind the garden. Out there, you know, and I found myself thinking, he may have stood on these rocks.
Right? That's what I think all the time. All exactly. Kind of
stuff. I really like that stuff. And I like fishing places I've read about and they were significant. And then we went in the house and the guy, the curator, whatever you call it, it was a kind of a historic place. We opened the closet door and there was this fishing vest hanging on the, you know, backside of the door. And so we looked in it and there was this pipe. And there was tobacco still in the pipe. I thought, oh. And then, okay, this goes farther. I took I can't remember how, but they had been cutting down some wood, trimming or some trees or something there. And so I asked the guy who was, you know, in charge of the place, I said, can I have a little piece of this wood? And he said, okay, sure. So he gave me a little piece of acacia wood. And I, later on, a guy was building a bamboo rod for me and he was going to build the reel seat. And I said, hold on a minute. So I gave him the piece of wood. So he put the reel seat, the wooden filler in the reel seat is from that piece of wood from a tree that Roderick Haig Brown planted.
Oh,
so that's the kind of stuff I really think is cool.
See, and it's funny. I just did an interview about this with the magazine. We were talking about why people fish bamboo rods. And he was asking me, the journalist was right, asking me why I enjoy fishing bamboo rods. And this is exactly what I was saying, is that I had started to lose a lot of the passion, but reading the history and going to these streams and fishing rods that a lot of these guys were using, or in your case, you know, parts of materials that were on their property or that they planted. Yeah. That is a connection that'll bring you back as well. Right.
Yeah, and that's the stuff I like. I'm much more interested in that than in Euro-nymphing. I'm sorry I said it.
Yeah, that's okay. It's a different, you know, different. It's different for everybody depending on the stage that we're in.
I should qualify what I just said about, you know, people not understanding the history of the sport. You know, for a long time, what was really apparent in the fly fishing industry and in the sport was that there weren't enough young people taking it up. I think that's been changing some. Is that your sense? I think it's been growing.
Jim, I'm going to say yes. Absolutely. It's like, it's okay. Absolutely blowing up. It's okay. Blown up. I don't know what the stats are showing and what license sales and all that data is showing, but I can tell you just by my own observation.
Yeah.
And social media does highlight it, but yes, I would say there are a lot more younger people.
Yeah. And that's good. We needed that. And I think we can probably thank social media for that.
In a lot of ways. Yeah. Yeah. I remember it being so painful. Oh, sorry. What's that?
And you doing what you're doing and other people, you know, it's good.
Thanks. I remember specifically actually, and it would have been 23 and I'm 37 now. So however many years ago that was, I was driving with my boyfriend at the time. And I think at the time I was getting bullied on Facebook or something. And I remember saying to him, I can't wait till there are other young women doing this. So I'm not just the old, this is so selfish and so horrible, but I'm going to admit it, so that I'm not the only one getting beat on all the time. And that I wasn't being malicious to other women. I just wanted to be able to have my tribe so that together we could stand united and not constantly be getting pissed on. Sorry, that's really vulgar, but that's what it felt like all the time. And so, I just remember going from feeling so alone back then to looking at it now. I would never have felt like I did back then if I was living in a day like we have today. There's so many of us, not just women, but young men and women together who can team up together and support each other.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And you know, I think you've had a lot to do with the women part of it. I mean, and it's
thanks.
Good on you for doing it. And thank you for doing it for all of us. It needed to happen. And so you and Joan,
it was always going to happen. It's just the evolution of us. So what's next for you, Jim? I am going to include links to your school and everything on the write up, but if anyone's in the area with this wait a second, you've got a workshop, but the pandemic's happening.
Yes, we're actually combining a fly fishing school weekend with the writing workshop weekend. And there's a total of, I think, 8 people, in a bed and breakfast with a big one with lots of room, lots of space. So we're going to follow all the rules. And it should be fine. The fishing stuff will be outdoors and it's easy to separate yourself there. And actually a lot of the writing stuff we'll probably do outside too, because it's probably going to be hot.
Well, look, I'm going to let you get back to your night because it's getting late there. Is there anything that, I mean, you've got an entire lifetime of this, but so I know I've missed stuff, but is there anything in particular that I've missed that you would like to add or to ask me?
No, I don't think so. I think you're really doing a good job on this stuff. I've listened to a few of the podcasts and, you know, with Gary Borger and John Garrick and what's great is that you're not constrained by time and these things, or at least not in a big way. You know, a lot of times when somebody, you get an interview, it's like 12 questions, then I got to hang up and go write the story or whatever. And so maybe that's what you're going to do now. I don't know, but
it's been good
to have gone a little farther down some of these rabbit trails. And I think because you do that is why you get good stuff out of people. So
thank you. Yeah. No, I got sick to death of being told that I had to do, have time limitations, sponsorship limitations, any sort of agenda. So the show is exactly as, I mean, it's, there's nobody is behind this pulling strings. It's just you guys telling us your stories. So thank you for sharing.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I have enjoyed it, and you should keep up the good work and, doing what you're doing with that little girl of yours and the rest of your family and your dog and everything. So you would normally be in BC now, right?
Yeah, we were in BC and then this whole thing hit and we did the frantic rush back. Because the problem is obviously with Colby, he can't be here. alone. He needs me here. But so I couldn't go anywhere anyway right now, if I'm being totally frank. But also, if I go to BC right now, I can't get back into, it's unlikely I'd be able to get back into Australia.
Right, right.
Without having to pay for 2 weeks of quarantine out of my own pocket. And I just, can you imagine being in a hotel room with a two-year-old by yourself? My palms are sweating just thinking about it. It's just a horrible thought.
Yeah. Wow.
So, but I'll go back when I can. Yeah. Yeah. And then, so Jim, just so people listening, are we going to be able to see some of your writing on Anchored Outdoors? We've been talking about
having
you do some writing.
Yes. I haven't done it yet, but I know that, we've talked about it and I do have plans. So. I'll get right on it. I'll get right on it. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
No worries. Cool. Well, I'll wrap it up. Jim, thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Great. I really appreciate it, April. Keep up the good work.
And that concludes this episode of Anchored. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. I read all of them and cannot thank you guys enough for tuning in. See you soon.
You want to succeed, you want to fish, you want to be one of the greatest.
Tune in to West Marine's Life on the Water, presented by Costa Custom Boats, every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. Don't miss Mondays with Into the Blue, brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors, every Monday night from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.